From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with New York Times foreign correspondent John Burns. He spent 3 weeks in Iraq last month. He was there for the election and for Saddam Hussein's amnesty that freed tens of thousands of political prisoners and criminals. Burns won a Pulitzer Prize for his coverage of the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan in 1997. Also, the Rolling Stones are celebrating their 40th year together as a band. In the first of a two-part series, rock historian Ed Ward takes a look at the early music of the Stones. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Republicans are riding high after yesterday's election victory, promising to enact President Bush's agenda in domestic and foreign policy, and hoping that the president's personal popularity will translate into legislation. NPR's Barbara Bradley Haggerty reports.
The dust had barely settled before Republicans began turning to their agenda. Republican leader Trent Lott, who will soon be Senate Majority Leader, says the vote yesterday suggests the American public likes the president's priorities.
What this message says is this president does have a country that trusts him, respects his leadership, and supports what he's trying to do for peace and democracy and security at home and around the world.
Of course, the Republicans will still have only a thin majority in the Senate, so they'll need to compromise. But even Democrats say the public has given the president the benefit of the doubt on issues like war with Iraq, homeland security, tax breaks, and federal judgeships. And now Republicans control the committees that consider such issues. Barbara Bradley Haggerty, NPR News, Washington.
Representative Dick Gephardt is reportedly planning to announce that he will not seek another term as leader of the House Democrats. The Associated Press quoted Gephardt's senior aides as saying the Missouri congressman will announce his decision tomorrow. Some top House Democrats, including Nancy Pelosi of California and Martin Frost of Texas, have said they'd run for the Democratic leadership if Gephardt stepped down. Republican Wayne Allard of Colorado held on to his U.S. Senate seat despite pre-election polls indicating a tight race with Democratic challenger Tom Strickland. NPR's Howard Berkus reports from Denver.
Colorado Senator Wayne Allard credits an 11th-hour Republican get-out-the-vote effort and visits by President Bush and Vice President Cheney for Republican victories in Colorado and across the country.
The president helped us lay out a clear message, and we were able to generate a lot of enthusiasm among our supporters. So the message is that Republicans did a better job in telling America what they were all about, and it paid off in this election.
Allard's victory comes in what veteran politicos here describe as one of the dirtiest campaigns in Colorado history, with ads focusing on corporate corruption, abortion, and Allard's record as one of the most conservative members of the Senate. The race may also be the most expensive ever for Colorado, with final spending estimated at $10 million. Howard Berkus, NPR News, Denver.
The UN Security Council met behind closed doors today to discuss the latest U.S. proposal for a resolution on Iraq. The Bush administration has changed the draft in an effort to overcome objections from France, Russia, and China, permanent members of the council who have the power to veto resolutions. In stocks, the Dow gained 93 points to close at 8,771. The NASDAQ gained 18 points. This is NPR News. There were more charges today against the man and the teenager accused in the Washington, D.C. area sniper murders. The prosecutor in Fairfax County, Virginia, charged John Allen Muhammad and John Lee Malvo in the killing of Linda Franklin, who was shot to death last month in a shopping mall. Prosecutor John Horan said that two of the charges carry the death penalty. He said he would seek to try Malvo, who's 17, as an adult. A study in this week's New England Journal of Medicine provides the most convincing evidence yet that the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine does not cause autism. NPR's Vicky Quay reports.
Researchers in Scotland and some parents have suggested the MMR vaccine triggers autism in young children. To find out, researchers in Denmark used a national registry to study all children born in Denmark between 1991 and 1998. They were able to determine whether the children were vaccinated and when. Then they looked at which children were diagnosed with autism. The researchers concluded the risk of autism and other related disorders was the same among the children who got the MMR vaccine and those who did not get the vaccine. Vicky Quay, NPR News.
A California jury has convicted actress Winona Ryder on two counts of shoplifting. The 31-year-old movie star was arrested last year at a Saks Fifth Avenue store in Beverly Hills. She was accused of stealing more than $5,000 in merchandise from the store, allegedly after cutting security tags from the clothing. The prosecutor in the case said she would not seek jail time for the actress, but would ask that she make restitution, perform community service, and serve probation time. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, maker of cholesterol-free vegetable oil, ADM, the nature of what's to come, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, New York Times foreign correspondent John Burns, reported from Iraq during the last 3 weeks of October. He was there for the election and witnessed the release of political prisoners and criminals after Saddam Hussein declared an amnesty. Since September 11th, Burns has been reporting mostly from Afghanistan and Pakistan, but he started reporting from the region long before 9/11. He won a Pulitzer Prize for his coverage of the Taliban's takeover of Afghanistan in 1997. He won his first Pulitzer in 1993 for his reporting from Bosnia. I spoke to Burns from the BBC in London yesterday. Before we talked about his impressions of Iraq, I asked about his meeting in Baghdad with the terrorist Abu Abbas. Burns' report on his interview with Abbas is about to be published in The Times. I asked Burns to describe who Abu Abbas is and how Burns got the interview.
In the summer of 1985, his splinter group of the Palestine Liberation Organization hijacked the Achille Lauro cruise ship in the Mediterranean with an intent, so they say now, to enter the Israeli port of Ashdod and attack naval installations. But the whole thing went awry when they shot and killed a 69-year-old American businessman from New York, Leon Klinghoffer, and then pushed him in his wheelchair into the sea. It was at the time, and I would say for a very long time, probably up until September the 11th, the sort of standard of remorseless brutality in terrorism. Abu Abbas was not on the ship. He was the general secretary of the Palestine Liberation Front. He was involved in negotiations in Egypt that freed the ship and ended any further killing. The hijackers and Abu Abbas then boarded an aircraft to fly to Tunis, where Yasser Arafat's headquarters then was. The aircraft was forced down by American fighters dispatched by President Reagan and forced to land in Sicily. The Italians released Abu Abbas, saying they had no direct evidence against him, and he left Italy and began a long nomadic tour, if you will, of the Middle East, which continues until this day. The Italians later reinstituted proceedings against him and, in fact, convicted him in the Klinghoffer killing.
So you caught up with Abu Abbas in Baghdad. How did you get an interview with him?
Chance, really. I saw him in the lobby of the Al Rashid Hotel, which is the principal hotel in Baghdad. I spoke to him, and I was surprised. I would have expected that he would flee. He didn't. I later discovered that he'd in fact had a conversation with a correspondent from Newsweek, which published a brief summary of what he had to say a week or two ago. He didn't give me his telephone number, but I went to the Palestine Liberation Organization's embassy, so-called, in Baghdad, and spoke to them, judging that it was likely that they would have his phone number, which they did, and I telephoned, and after a little bit of evasiveness, they invited me to go to what in effect is their headquarters now in a suburb of Baghdad.
What were you able to learn about any connection that Palestinian groups might have with Iraq or with Al-Qaeda?
Well, Mr. Abbas, and really this was the heart of the interview, other than his reiteration of his regret over the killing of Mr. Klinghoffer and his insistence that he, not being on the ship, was not involved and had never intended that that should happen. The core of my discussion with him really was his attitude towards the events of September the 11th. And he was contemptuous of Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda for what they did in attacking the World Trade Center. He didn't mention the Pentagon because I think under the kind of rubric that he now uses in this matter, he would have seen that differently. But what he had to say about the World Trade Center was that whilst he rejects the word of the use of the word terrorism when applied to himself, he regards that as a terrorist action. He regards al-Qaeda as a terrorist group. And the distinction he makes, it's a very fine one, is that the Palestine Liberation Organization and its splinter groups are fighting what he describes as a historic battle for the liberation of Palestine or of the occupied lands. It is a specific objective, it's a secular objective. And whilst the enemies in this struggle are America and Israel, they have not declared war on Americans and Israelis or Americans and Jews in the way that Mr. bin Laden has. He described the attack on the World Trade Center. He talked of watching it on television, as so many of us did, and said that he found that there was no political purpose in this. He described it as mysterious, as if he would wish to find some explanation other than the one that bin Laden and al-Qaeda have offered. But in any event, his conclusion was, and his words were, that is terrorism.
And why is Baghdad a safe place for him to be living now?
Well, because, as you know, Baghdad has been for quite a long time a sort of Iraq has been a sort of pariah state. President Bush has said that Saddam Hussein has provided sanctuary to al-Qaeda fugitives, al-Qaeda terrorists. And Saddam Hussein, of course, has his own reasons related to the Palestine, the struggle over between Israel and Palestine. He's appointed himself, as you know, the sort of Saladin of the modern age, that is to say, the man who will ultimately be the liberator of Palestine. He's established his so-called Al-Quds army, Al-Quds, an Arabic word meaning Jerusalem, in which he's enrolled something over 1 million Iraqis. It's a fictitious army as far as one can judge it. But that's the posture that Saddam Hussein has taken over the struggle over the occupied territories. As you know, it has quite an appeal across the Arab Muslim world. And as part of that, he's given sanctuary to Abu Abbas and, for all I know, other people like him. It's so difficult to get into Iraq, to get out of Iraq for that matter, that it's probably the safest place for Abu Abbas to be now. But I don't know that there are any other sanctuaries left. As a matter of fact, my guess is the reason that he spoke to me was that there is no other obvious sanctuary after Iraq. He professed not to be concerned about that, saying that he has already lost so much in his struggle personally and that America has already done so much damage to his cause. But it was pretty obvious from people around him, and there are apparently about 30 people with this group, that they are not indifferent to this prospect. In my presence, they were discussing, you know, where would we go if American armed forces came to Baghdad? And I doubt that they have any answer to that.
Do you think that Abu Abbas's rejection of al-Qaeda's terrorism in attacking the World Trade Center is indicative of any larger rejection of it? I mean, do you think he's just speaking for himself, or do you think he represents any larger group right now?
Well, this, of course, is a conundrum. Osama bin Laden was a sort of Johnny-come-lately to the Palestinian cause. He only really started speaking out about it with any vehemence in the last year or so before September the 11th. And it's a point that Abu Abbas and indeed others in the more radical wing of the Palestinian struggle have made, that they've not found Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda convincing on this point, not least because they will tell you they've done nothing for the cause. The targets they have chosen are not the targets the Palestinians would have chosen. I think there's also is a discomfort. I don't think that people, even people quite radical in the Palestinian movement, would regard what happened on September the 11th as helpful to their cause. and all the evidence, of course, available to anybody who looks at it objectively, is that it hasn't been helpful to their cause, quite the contrary. So I think it's a distinction that you might find being made by quite a few people. As to the moral distinction that Abu Abbas and others make between events like the killing of Mr. Klinghoffer and the killing of innocents in the Twin Towers, that's counting angels on the head of a pin. I don't think that many Americans or many Westerners would find that very convincing, since in both cases it involved innocent death. But it's nonetheless a distinction that you hear quite commonly across the Middle East.
My guest is New York Times foreign correspondent John Burns. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. John Burns is my guest. He's a foreign correspondent for the New York Times, and he's spent a lot of time in Afghanistan and that region lately. He just returned to London from 3 weeks in Iraq. John Burns, would you explain how you were let into Iraq and then why you had to leave Iraq?
Well, as you know, visas for American correspondents to Iraq are much sought after, but the floodgates were opened in October. We were told in Baghdad at fairly senior level by Saddam Hussein himself, who decided that the blacklist, which they refer to in by that word, the blacklist, should be suspended for the purpose of the presidential referendum, the one candidate presidential referendum that was held on October the 15th. It's quite revealing, this, because you might think it odd that anybody as hard-headed as Saddam Hussein could actually believe that holding a referendum in which there's only one candidate, in which 11.4 million people vote, that's 100% of the eligible voters, and 100% of them vote for Saddam Hussein, by the Iraqi claim, you might think that that would be, even they would understand that in the world from which we come, that would be regarded as incredible, simply not believable. But the evidence, the available evidence, is that Saddam Hussein actually believes that an event of that kind will influence the world outside Iraq. And therefore, he was prepared to suspend the blacklist, and they invited several hundred reporters in. We were given 10-day visas, which were then extended, in my case, twice until the 3-week point, and then we were all told to leave. And my guess is that we might have been able to stay longer, but for the protests that occurred in the streets of Baghdad after Saddam Hussein astonishingly amnestied virtually everybody in Iraq out of the prisons. Probably 200,000 or more people were simply emptied out of the prisons. In the immediate aftermath of this, people took to the streets to demonstrate, because since quite a number of people, certainly thousands, maybe tens of thousands, who have been arrested by the Iraqi secret police, got to prison, or if they did get to prison, disappeared. The protests were made by widows and others looking for those who did not come out of the prisons. At the time, it was clearly a huge embarrassment to the government. And CNN was told to withdraw all their non-Iraqi staff, which would, of course, have severely handicapped their operations there. And then the most extraordinary thing happened. Whilst this crisis for all the media was underway, all of a sudden, Saddam Hussein's oldest son, Uday Saddam Hussein, who's been no friend of the independent media before, denounced the information ministry through the medium of a newspaper he controls in Baghdad, Babil, saying that they had completely mishandled the coverage of the protests, and it was time, and this was the word they used, to understand that much has changed since the 1970s, which was the decade when his father rose to power, and that it's time for Iraq to adjust to the so-called fact-searching media of the 21st century. Although they didn't suspend the orders that we should all leave on the expiry of our visas, it caused an extraordinary and immediate change in the attitude within the Ministry of Information, who all of a sudden became quite welcoming and told us if we went away that we could come back when the weapons inspectors arrive in Baghdad, which, of course, everybody expects to happen within a matter of weeks.
I guess what confused me most, there were many confusing things, but I think what confused me most about the amnesty was that Saddam Hussein not only released political prisoners, he released murderers and other criminals. And so you can't just see it as, well, he's backing down from a certain degree of totalitarianism and opening the door to a little more dissent, because he's also opening the door for murderers. And you wonder, what's the point of letting the murderers out?
Well, you can be sure that many Iraqis wondered the same question. They were not at all happy any more than Americans would be if every murderer, rapist and thief was suddenly released onto the streets. And among the dissident thoughts which in a rush reached us in the aftermath of what happened at Abu Ghraib was precisely that. What do they think they're doing, exposing us to this risk? My guess is that that there were both a domestic and an international dimension to this. The international dimension was to meet President Bush's insistent descriptions of Saddam Hussein and his regime as a murdering tyrant. So I think on the international dimension, the purpose was to try and persuade the world that this is not true, or at least if it was true, it's not true anymore. Domestically, I think the key was in a speech that Saddam Hussein gave after for his inauguration, for his new seven-year term to which he was elected by this curious referendum on the 15th of October, where in a long and very rambling speech, there was a passage in which he used an image apparently drawn from the Quran, in which he described himself as holding the bucket at the well and said that he was ready to dispense clear, pure water to those who needed it. It was a passage about forgiveness. So he seemed intent on persuading his own people that he was capable of change and would govern in a different way in the future. That, to me, is the more interesting dimension of all of this, the sense that he needs at this time to appeal to Iraqis whom you might feel were lost to him.
Can you tell us where you stood when the prison you were watching was emptied and how you chose your vantage point to observe what was happening?
Well, we were summoned at short notice to the Information Ministry on a Sunday morning and then driven at 120 miles an hour west of Baghdad. As soon as we began to exit the city of the west, it was clear where we were going. Anybody who knows anything at all about Iraq under Saddam Hussein knows what Abu Ghraib is. We arrived at the gates of the prison, and at this point we'd not been told what it was all about, but at noon a broadcast from the state radio told us that the president was amnestying all prisoners in Iraq, with the exception of Zionist and American spies and murderers who'd made no acquittance with the victims' families and so forth. But in fact, the restricted terms of the amnesty came to mean nothing very quickly, because an enormous crowd built up at the gates. Initially, a crowd of a sort of rent a crowd of people who were hoisting Saddam Hussein's portraits and shouting his name. But the crowd quickly became unmanageable and, in fact, broke through the gates, the outer gates of a prison that is completely vast. I would say at least a mile square in every direction and maybe 2 miles square. In fact, it's prisons within a prison. The crowd burst through, and through the next hours into the night, built up the mob to at least 50 and maybe 100,000 people. And any intent to regulate who got out of that prison was lost in the chaos. We were swept into the gates with the mob. I hesitate to call it a mob because we're talking about people who in many cases, of course, were just desperate to find long-lost husbands, fathers, sons. And they then ranged prison to prison, or cell block, if you will. The prisoners who got out raced without exception to the gates, never fearing, of course, that that something equally extraordinary might happen and that they might reverse the amnesty. Some did not get out immediately, and it wasn't exactly clear why they were held. And in one cell block in particular, Division 6, at the southern end of this compound, a panic developed towards dusk, in which prisoners surging toward a sort of cinder block wall, which was the last barrier between them and freedom, pushed forward and were then driven back by guards. And in the confusion and melee, people died. Our judgment, the photographer Tyler Hicks from the New York Times and myself, was that they had died in the main from suffocation, trampled to death. Although steel tubing had been used by some guards to beat others back, it wasn't plain to us that anybody had actually suffered fatal injuries from that. So I think it's fair to say that things simply got out of hand. And it was a sort of the storming of the Bastille, mm-hmm. if you will, 223 years later.
Although you think that Saddam Hussein probably opened the prisons in the hopes of winning more support and love from his people, you think this might have backfired?
I think it did. I think myself, the critical moment in all of this, and possibly the critical moment in the modern history of Iraq, came not when he announced the amnesty, but 2 hours later when the gates were opened. Until that moment, it was Iraq as usual, in the sense that it was a controlled event. And I think that regimes that have total control of their people find it difficult to imagine what happens when they lose control. In my judgment, when the gates broke open, something historic happened. The people of Iraq became sovereign at that moment. There was no law and order within that prison. There was complete chaos. There was still some cheering for Saddam Hussein, but all of a sudden there was the most extraordinary scenes, if you will, of liberty, people shouting for freedom and democracy, people in some cases shouting the name of President Bush, prisoners as they raced for the exits. So I think that whatever calculations might have been made by the government of Iraq prior to 2 o'clock or 2:30 p.m. on that Sunday afternoon, they all went awry after that. And one thing that I think was strange that was not calculated was that naturally anybody who heard that radio broadcast who had lost a relative, and not I've been mentioning fathers and brothers and sons because Abu Ghraib is a male-only prison, but there are women prisons that are the counterpart of Abu Ghraib. Anybody who'd lost a relative was obviously going to rush to the prison where they thought they might be, and the inevitable consequence of that was going to be that the last hope that they might have disappeared into the gulag and might emerge was lost. Within 48 hours, when those lost, missing people did not turn up, it was pretty plain what had happened to them and that they never would turn up. And that became a very difficult issue for the Baghdad government to manage, as you may imagine.
John Burns is a foreign correspondent for the New York Times. We'll talk more about his 3 weeks in Iraq in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of I, Richard by Elizabeth George, author of A Traitor to Memory, and the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, rock historian Ed Ward presents the first of a two-part series on the 40-year career of the Rolling Stones. And we continue our conversation with New York Times foreign correspondent John Burns about his 3 weeks reporting from Iraq. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with John Burns, a foreign correspondent for The New York Times. He just spent 3 weeks in Iraq, where he covered the election and Saddam Hussein's amnesty, which freed tens of thousands of Iraqi political prisoners and criminals. Burns has mostly been covering Afghanistan and Pakistan since September 11th. He won a Pulitzer Prize for his coverage of the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan in 1997. When we left off, we were talking about how Iraq was changed by the amnesty. Did people start speaking to you in a different way about Saddam Hussein after the release of the prisoners?
They did, and I think it needs to be said. Again, you have to remember what Iraq is, what kind of a place it is. These were isolated incidents, here and there and now and then. And, of course, all the while, anybody who had a television camera put in front of him or anybody confronted in a sort of formal setting by a reporter with a notebook and a government minder present was going to say the same thing as they've always said, that we love our president, that we will defend him and the government of Iraq to the end, that the Americans, if they send their troops here, will face a bloodbath and will be defeated and so forth. To my mind, and this has always been true, that is nothing near as significant as what people say in those brief moments when they feel themselves free to express their opinions. It can happen in a hotel elevator. It can happen in a bookshop when somebody brushes up to you and the minder is not paying any attention. It can happen on an airport apron when there's a jet engine running and nobody can overhear what is being said, whispered into your ear. All of these circumstances I'm familiar with. The difference was that there was a sudden rush of such occasions after the prison amnesty, and it's quite frightening. It's very frightening, I'm sure, for the people who do it, who do it with a look of terror in their faces. It's also a little frightening for people who hear this, because I don't think that anybody's going to knock a correspondent of the New York Times on the head, to be engaged in listening to dissident opinions is in a serious business there.
What are some of the things that people told you that you don't think they would have said before the opening of the prisons?
Well, I'll tell you one of them, which probably expresses as well as anything else. Mm-hmm. It wasn't the most incendiary, but the slogan for the referendum was Nam Nam in Arabic, yes, yes, Saddam. Somebody came up to me in a bookshop, not far from one of the principal detention centers of the regime, a place that is extremely forbidding. And he said, and it was plain he had rehearsed this, he knew he would only have a matter of seconds to say what he wanted to say, because there were banners hanging from this building that we could see saying, Nam Nam Saddam. He said, the banner that the Iraqi people wish to hang from their homes is Nam Nam Bush, Nam Nam America, yes, yes, Bush, yes, yes, America. And he went on to say that there are 22 million people in this country, and every one of them has 100 stories to tell of suffering under this government. He said other things. Now, people who do that, if they get caught, in the past, unless the entire system changed on that Sunday afternoon with the prison amnesty, are in effect throwing away their lives. And as they will tell you, those are their families as well. That's why it's so frightening. You know the enormous risk they're taking for themselves in saying these things. As to the larger question of how widespread these feelings are, of course, that's absolutely impossible to tell. But my guess is that events in the 1990s have severely narrowed down the basis of support on which that government stands, and that there are a lot of people who are hoping that the events now in progress will lead to their liberation.
You know, I'm wondering now that the Western reporters have been told to leave Iraq, I'm wondering if the Iraq police aren't rounding up people again and putting them back into the prisons.
Simply no way of knowing. I remember the first editor I worked for at the New York Times, when I joined New York Times back in the mid-1970s, said something to me one night when I was just sort of learning my way there. He said, remember to tell the readers not just what you know, but what you don't know. It was a tremendous liberation for me, because I think at that time, as a young reporter, I was always striving for sort of the whole truth, which, of course, is not knowable. Well, if there's any place in Iraq, in the world where it's important for people, Americans, to know what we do not know, it's Iraq. There's an enormous amount we don't know because we are so controlled. So, you know, a lot of these answers have to be speculative. We simply don't know what the Mohabarat, the secret police, has been doing since that amnesty. Mm-hmm. We do know that within 24 hours we were barred from entering Abu Ghraib. As a matter of fact, an Italian film crew that ventured out there 12 hours later had their film taken. Seemed to be an unlikely thing to do if Abu Ghraib was henceforth simply to be, a bunch of abandoned buildings. Human Rights Watch, amongst others, have chronicled some specific institutions which we know nothing about, well-known detention centers. They include the National Olympic Building, extraordinarily, in Baghdad, which apparently is used as a detention center. We simply don't know. And there's really no way to find out. Any attempt to find out these things would be attended by quite considerable risk.
My guest is John Burns. He's a foreign correspondent for the New York Times. He spent 3 weeks in Iraq and was told to leave along with other Western journalists last week. The Kurds have a lot of reason to hate Saddam Hussein. He gassed the Kurds in 1988, and he's practiced a form of ethnic cleansing, deporting Kurds from Iraqi cities and moving them to the Kurdish region in northern Iraq. In fact, you've described his policy as nationality. He's described his policy, I think, as nationality correction. What does that mean?
Well, I think in Balkan terms, it's what we call ethnic cleansing. A fundamental demographic fact of Iraq in the 20th century was that the richest oil fields lay in an area where there was a Kurdish majority in north central Iraq. We have to say, to be fair to the present government of Iraq, that the Arabization of that area was not something that Saddam Hussein introduced. As a matter of fact, as a citizen of the United Kingdom, I'm ashamed to say that it was something that my father's generation in Iraq, after the founding of Iraq as a sort of British protectorate in 1921, also followed. Why? Because, for a lot of reasons, but one of them was, I think, that they found that the Arabs of Iraq were more reliable allies for a British colonial enterprise. But this whole process has been intensified under Saddam Hussein and become very painful. And a lot of people, 100,000, possibly 200,000, have fled out of the predominantly Kurdish areas of north central Iraq into the protectorate, in effect, that's been created by the no-fly zone in northern Iraq. And it's an important component, of course, in what lies ahead now, because there is, in effect, if you want to talk in Afghan terms, a sort of northern alliance area in northern Iraq. That's to say, an area, a considerable area, 10 to 12% of the territory of Iraq, which has airfields and other military installations, which is not under Saddam Hussein's control and is, in fact, in the control of people who, as you said, are in the main very hostile to him.
But even though the Kurds in the north are hostile to Saddam Hussein, do you think that the United States can just assume that they'll support the United States if the United States invades Iraq?
No, I don't think you can. There are Kurdish leaders who will say to you privately, we won't have any choice. Devil in the deep blue sea, because if an American invasion of Iraq were to fail, then the Kurdish protectorate in the north would also almost inevitably collapse with terrible consequences for anybody who's been in a position of authority there. My guess is that in the main, they're hoping that President Bush in his military planning, if he does intend an invasion of Iraq, will give them a pass. That he will do it mainly by air power from the north. I don't know that it'll be easy for the United States to use that territory in northern Iraq for other reasons, which has to do with Turkey and Iran, both of whom have extreme sensitivities, of course, about Kurdish autonomy in Iraq, seeing it as possibly a platform for the Kurds to resume their historic push for a Kurdish state, which would occupy a good deal of Iran, Turkey, Iraq and Syria. So it's a very, very complicated issue. We do know that people from the CIA, from the Pentagon and other American government institutions have been in northern Iraq in recent months. And it surely, I think one thing we can assume is that northern Iraq will not be excluded from this enterprise, but just how it would be included at this point is impossible to say.
Well, another complicating factor is that there's an extremist Islamic group known in English as Soldiers of God, that's in that northern area that would certainly oppose a U.S. invasion.
They would. It's a very striking thing. There's an area, possibly not more than 100 square miles, but still you can do a lot with 100 square miles, that immediately abuts the Iranian border in northeastern Iraq. So we're talking about a part of Iraq which is immediately to the north and east of the city of Halabja, known to Americans as the place that Saddam Hussein's Air Force dropped chemical weapons in March of 1988 with catastrophic effects. As if the people of Halabja have not suffered enough, what they have now is an extremist Islamic group that controls the valleys and mountains to the east leading to the Iranian border. And we do know that that group has al-Qaeda links. When I last looked at this, there were said to be about 500 or 600 people in that group, of whom possibly as many as 150 were fugitives from Taliban-ruled Afghanistan. That's to say people who had crossed Iran and entered into that sanctuary in northeastern Iraq within the past year or so. What was a little bit odd about this was because you can actually go to the periphery of this territory and look down into these valleys and actually see these people. What's a little odd about this is that although they have attacked into the Kurdish area, they've attempted to assassinate Kurdish leaders, they've created absolute mayhem by attacking military bunkers established by the Kurds around Halabja, killing a dozen or more people at a time. What's a bit strange about this was that the Bush administration said virtually nothing about this, or wasn't keen to talk about it until relatively recently. And it's not clear to me why that was. After all, they would fire Predator missiles, missiles from Predator drones over Yemen to kill a single al-Qaeda leader and his associates. And here was a known concentration of at least 100 or 150 of these people inside Iraq. I think what this tells us is the extreme sensitivities of the region and how the Bush administration does not wish, for one thing, to disturb the Turks or the Iranians by mounting military operations inside Iraq, even inside the Kurdish-controlled sector of Iraq, until it's made the larger decisions about what to do about Iraq proper. That, to my mind, is the only way to understand the fact that those people in those valleys, those al-Qaeda-linked people, have so far been left alone.
My guest is New York Times foreign correspondent John Burns. Our interview was recorded yesterday from the BBC in London. Today's New York Times reports that the Iraqi Kurdish leader said that Iran had promised military help to oust the Islamic militants in northern Iraq. We'll hear more from John Burns after a break. This is Fresh Air. John Burns is my guest. He's a foreign correspondent for the New York Times, and he just spent 3 weeks in Iraq. He was asked to leave last week along with other Western journalists. I just want to ask you a question about the position you're in when you're a Western reporter in Iraq. One of your articles for the New York Times was about a tour that you were given by, you know, Iraqi representatives, I forget who it was, you know, who actually took you on this tour, of an industrial plant, a plant that the United States said was being used to rebuild Iraq's nuclear weapons program. And the point of this tour for the Western press was to show, no, this plant is not being used for nuclear weapons. Well, how are you supposed to be able to tell the difference? I mean, what a sham, but yet you're certainly going to go, right? I mean,
it's absurd on its face, and of course that's the first thing, and I don't exactly remember how I wrote about that, but
you made it pretty clear that you thought the whole thing, you know,
it was a farce and a sham, and
yeah.
There was no way, we knew this, at least those of us who care to think about it knew, there was no way that tour was going to prove one thing or the other. And in fact, the way in which the tour was conducted made it impossible even to determine the one thing that might have been really useful, which is that President Bush had released, in company with that speech in October, photographs of this installation. It's called Al Furat. It's about 25 miles southwest of Baghdad. And one thing we know for sure is that Al Furat was, up until the mid-1990s, a place where the Iraqis were attempting to develop a system for enriching uranium for the purpose of building nuclear weapons. That's not in dispute. The question is what happened after the weapons inspectors left. President Bush released photographs, the White House released photographs of this installation with one particular building, a large hangar-sized building, which apparently was the building that would once again be used for this experimental enrichment process. But we weren't even allowed near that. The whole thing was absurd. If they set out to prove it wasn't being used for that purpose, then the obvious thing to do would have been to take us into that building. We never got to that building. And my guess is that whatever was about to happen at Al Furat was no longer going to happen after President Bush released those photographs. We went from building to building and into offices where it looked like equipment had been pushed in a hurry. And there were secretaries sitting at computers who seemed to have not the first idea what the computers were for. They still sat there staring blankly at the desktops on their computers, and only actually started to do anything if a reporter approached them and asked them what their purpose in being there was. The equipment that had been wheeled into this place was absurd. There was, for example, a Soviet-era pod to be hung beneath the wing of a military aircraft, which was some sort of radar jamming device. Taking a look at this thing, I would think that it was at least 20 or 25 years old and hadn't been operational probably for most of that time. None of it made sense, and nothing was proved one way or the other by taking us there.
So your article about this tour was really very skeptical. Do you think that the Iraqis, you know, the Iraqi government reads what you write for the New York Times? Do they know what you're saying?
You'd have to think that a government that has battened down the hatches as tightly as that one has would watch very carefully what Western reporters are saying and watch pretty carefully the internet. But my feeling is, I might be wrong about this, that in the present crisis, their priorities have shifted somewhat. And that in strange ways, we've become somewhat less important and somewhat less relevant to them than before. This is all about survival. And my guess is that if you could ask Saddam Hussein or Tariq Aziz or Izzat Ibrahim or any of the regime leaders about people like me, I would be very low on their list of priorities. I'd be almost invisible.
What are your hopes for returning to Iraq?
Well, of course, I want to go back very badly. At any one point in time for a foreign correspondent, there's going to be one place that everybody wants to be more than any other. And right now, that's Baghdad. A year ago, it was Kabul. So to be excluded would be very disappointing. And I should say that, I would say this, wouldn't I? But I happen to believe it's true. And that's certainly something I said to Tariq Aziz, the deputy prime minister, who is their sort of principal interlocutor for the government. I said, when I met him during this trip to Baghdad, I said, to be realistic, I cannot expect that you will much like much of what I or people like me write. But I think that we're useful anyway, because I think that you, above all, right now, need to keep open a dialogue with the United States. And one thing you can be pretty sure of with the New York Times is that if you have anything pertinent to say about what's at the heart of this crisis, it will be in the New York Times tomorrow and it will be accurately reported. And he said to me, of course, we know that you people write lies about us. And I said to him, well, let's do a deal here. If I report this interview in a way that is in even one small way inaccurate, throw me out. If I don't, then take me as true to my word. So I sent him a copy of my article that I'd written, and a few days later I saw him in the lobby of the Al Rashid Hotel, and he was very congenial. So I think there is a recognition that that we are useful in circumstances like this, and that cut off that, if you will, dialogue with the world would be very unhelpful.
John Burns, good luck to you, and thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
John Burns is a foreign correspondent for the New York Times. He spoke to us from the BBC in London. Coming up, it's the 40th anniversary of the Rolling Stones. Rock historian Ed Ward focuses on their early years. This is Fresh Air. The Rolling Stones are celebrating their 40th year together. The anniversary-related events include the re-release of the Stones' entire early catalog on Abco Records, remixed and remastered. In the first of a two-part series, rock historian Ed Ward talks about the band's very earliest days.
Sometime in London in the summer of 1962, above a long-vanished pub called the White Bear, a young man fought a lonely battle. He was trying to start a blues band in London. His name was Brian Jones, and he'd been encouraged by the man who almost single-handedly brought blues to Britain, Alexis Korner, a half-Italian, half-Austrian guitarist with the Chris Barber Band. During the intermissions, Korner and his harmonica-playing pal, Cyril Davies, would play songs they'd learned from old blues records, and this Jones kid would come up from the suburbs in Cheltenham to hear them. Eventually, the duo became a band, Blues Incorporated, and had a weekly gig in suburban Ealing. Their drummer was probably the youngest member, a jazz fan who worked at an ad agency, a job that bored him. His name was Charlie Watts. People came from as far away as Scotland to see the gigs at the Ealing Club, and eventually Brian wasn't hitchhiking from home anymore. He was sleeping under the Korner's kitchen table. We'd tell people, "Oh, don't mind him, that's just Brian," Korner's wife Bobby told me. He was calling himself Elmo Lewis and would sit in for a number on slide guitar.
The little red rooster, too lazy to crow for day.
One night, a couple of school chums, Mike Jagger and Keith Richards, who had bonded over their mutual enthusiasm for blues and Chuck Berry, came to Ealing and were blown away by Elmo Lewis. After the show, they chatted with him, and he mentioned that he was starting a band, something Alexis Korner had urged him to do. Jagger had been fooling around with blues himself, and he gave Korner a tape. Before long, Blues Incorporated had a new lead singer, now calling himself Mick. Meanwhile, Brian put an ad in the magazine Jazz News for his project, claiming they had plenty of interesting work available and needed harmonica, sax, piano, bass, and drums. First to answer was Ian Stewart, a solidly built piano player with fine boogie-woogie chops. Guitarist Dick Taylor showed up at the White Bear, too. And in June, so did Mick and Keith, which meant Taylor switched to bass. Drummer Mick Avery completed the band. In July, Blues Incorporated was offered a spot on a television program on the same night as they would have played the Ealing Club, so Alexis asked Brian if his band could fill in. Oh, and did they have a name? Yes, the Rolling Stones. Before long, Brian, Mick, and Keith moved into a ratty flat near the King's Road in Chelsea, staying up late and playing Muddy Waters records.
I don't want, 'cause I'm sad and blue. I just
They had sporadic gigs throughout the fall, and in December 1962, things came together. First, Charlie Watts quit Blues Incorporated because he didn't think he was good enough. Second, an older veteran of several rock and roll bands, Bill Perks, showed up at a rehearsal above the Weatherby Arms around the corner from the boys' apartment. He was much better on bass than Dick Taylor, who wanted to play guitar. They let him go, and he later founded the Pretty Things. Charlie Watts, too, auditioned, and since they didn't have a permanent drummer, a band was born. By the spring of 1963, there was a club circuit in London for this music and a couple of other bands playing it. Jazz fogies didn't like it, but kids did, and they showed up in droves. Naturally, this sort of thing attracted attention. The Stones made a demo record and sent it to a couple of record companies, but were turned down. Then, a 19-year-old half-American kid with a lot of guts saw them in late April and immediately offered to be their manager. His name was Andrew Luke Oldham, and right away he made some changes. First, Ian Stewart was to become road manager and not play on stage because the band was too big. Second, Bill Perks' name change to Bill Wyman was a good idea. Third, Keith Richards would drop the S from his name. Fourth, the G went back on the end of Rolling Stones. Right, and now into the studio.
Everything is wrong since me and my baby parted. All day long I'm walking cause I couldn't get my car started. Later from my job and I can't afford to check it. I wish somebody come along and run into it and wreck it. Come on, since me and my baby parted. Come on, I can't get started. Come on, I can't afford to check it. I wish somebody come along and run into it and wreck it. Everything is wrong.
It was too fast. The recording quality was awful. But this Chuck Berry song got to number 25 on the British charts, and the Rolling Stones were on their way.
Ed Ward lives in Berlin. He'd like to dedicate this piece to the memory of Alexis Korner. Later in the week, Ed reviews the Stones' re-released albums. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer this week is Roberta Schurach. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Bill Maher, former host of the show Politically Incorrect. He has a new book called When You Ride Alone, You Ride with Bin Laden, what the government should be telling us to help fight the war on terrorism. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.